Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
A website called The Onion openly traffics in fake news as parody. But last year, different, more insidious fake stories popped up everywhere, finding their way onto many people's radar screens through their electronic ones in the form of viral content spread on social media. Deliberately untrue stories about Hillary Clinton's involvement in a child sex conspiracy and Pope Francis's endorsement of then-candidate Donald Trump were among dozens that appeared on websites that looked very similar to legitimate news sites. An Ipsos poll conducted last month revealed that fake news headlines fool us about 75% of the time. And now many Americans no longer trust what is reported even by legitimate sources. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. This is a problem for democratic society, and it's also a problem for traditional news organizations who, after decades of assuming their audiences trusted them, now find themselves accused of publishing bogus stories by very powerful people, including the president-elect of the United States. Joining us to talk about this strange climate are Alfredo Carbajal, editor of Aldea, and Mike Wilson, editor of the Dallas Morning News. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having us.
A Gallup poll released in September offered a very sobering conclusion, which is that only 32% of Americans overall say they have a great deal or even a fair amount of trust in the media. That's down 8 points from the year before. It's worse among Republicans, a little better among Democrats in terms of how much they trust the media. What has pushed us to a moment, Alfredo, when so many people distrust the sources they once trusted?
Well, obviously, we are in a very complex situation where we have different kinds of media, and also in many cases, in some cases, sometimes the news media, you know, we have reported elements that are not completely truth or information hasn't been fully vetted. But in my case, one of the things that I see, it's also this tremendous fragmentation of media. We have entertainment media, and we have other special interest media, and then we have what I call responsible news media. And usually the public will address all of this as just one gigantic basket of the media, and sometimes do not discern between who is doing verification information, not only presenting facts, but also the truth behind those facts, and also the implications and the impact on what those facts are. And I think sometimes the public do not see that we have different elements that are trying to do a responsible job in terms of presenting information as truthful and again, the impact of what those facts mean. It has to do with the fact, again, that sometimes we don't have a broad media literacy, you know, culture in our country. And there are many factors for that, and hopefully we can find some answers for that, too.
Mike, this is clearly a challenge for news organizations, and it's not something that's brand new. We've been struggling with it for a while. But what do you think are the consequences of a lack of trust in the lots of people dislike the term traditional media these days, but the bona fide media, working with bona fide journalists, the consequences of a lack of trust in those organizations for society?
I think they're important and very, very deep consequences. Without a lack of trust in good information, you start to see, I think, the erosion of democratic values, democratic norms. You know, recently in the New York Times, Roger Cohen, the columnist, wrote a sentence that really stuck with me. He said, you know, America is an idea. And, of course, it's a nation of laws, but there are laws established on a sense of sort of shared ideals that we have as Americans. And those are fueled as much by what we commonly believe as they are by what are the laws that govern the country. And so if you have people who simply think there is no truth or that truth is completely elastic, then you have sort of nothing to gather around as a society to believe in and to act upon. And so I think it's a very serious problem.
There's certainly an idea among a lot of people that the media are holding out or holding back or using their power, I should say our power because we all work in this industry, to promote an agenda. And the tricky part is that does exist, but it's not at every news organization.
I think that's an interesting point, and we have to acknowledge and think about our responsibility, not so much in having an agenda that we're pursuing, but in being more transparent about why we do what we do. I think there's a little bit of mystery among some of our readers about why we report certain things or don't report certain other things. And we can do a better job in terms of labeling stories, explaining to readers what is the writer's background in or qualifications to say what he or she is saying. I think that one of the lessons that I've really learned from this last election cycle is there's more that we can tell readers about how we do what we do and to sort of pull back the curtain for them a little bit.
It is interesting that in our profession we love transparency from corporations and from government people, but we sort of have liked to keep the way we make the sausage under wraps.
Right. And you know, I think that there's one more element on this issue, which is a lot of elements on the public, they already have their mind set up on what they want to believe on. So there's this concept in journalism called confirmation bias, which is a lot of people, they already believe in something and they read media and they consume media based on what they believe on or based on the information going to be provided. It's going to either be confirming or it's going to be in sync with what they believe on. That's an interesting element, because also another element that we need to do if we want to be responsible media, news media, is also we want to be inclusive. So in many cases, obviously, you want to incorporate as many voices as you can have on a story about whatever issue we're dealing with. But if we know that for a fact some of those elements or some of those facts are not truth or are, as Mike's saying, elastic, you know, people are trying to just spin some of the elements of that, then we're going to have an issue there where we're going to be representing the truth. We're going to be reporting facts based on how different people will perceive those facts, but not the truth of the element.
I'm also really interested in this thing called the illusory truth effect, which is that the more often people hear a fact, even a fact that they know at the outset is not true, the more likely all of us are to believe it. And maybe if it's something tiny, it's not a big deal. But there are a lot of really completely false stories that have come to seem true to people.
I think that's right. I experienced that firsthand in dealing with our audience's reaction to the Dallas Morning News recommendation of Hillary Clinton for president. This was not...
this was the editorial board.
It was the editorial board position that recommending her for president over President Trump. And I got a lot of reaction that was very reasonable, politically based, and a principled opposition to Hillary Clinton. But I got a lot of other reaction, and maybe even a majority of the reaction that I personally received was outrage based on sets of facts that I did not have reporting to support. So there are many, many stories about Hillary Clinton in this election cycle that took on a patina of truth that I can only say as a journalist, I'm not able to confirm using journalistic methods. For example, I am not able to confirm that Hillary Clinton personally killed 47 people in Arkansas. That though is held out to me as an absolute fact by more than one reader who was outraged at our editorial position.
Would you try to confirm something like that sounds at the outset to be not true?
So something that outlandish I wouldn't spend much time on. Other things that people would bring up, I would do either I already knew the answer, or I would do research as best I could into what were the underlying facts. And, you know, in many cases, there was, of course, a very strong sort of sense of partisanship behind what they were saying, that it was a more of a wishful belief than an actual set of facts about her. So, you know, it was very discouraging to feel like we had a newspaper and a newspaper staff trying to present the reality about Hillary Clinton, but running into this sort of wall of denial or anger from people who opposed her. Now, that I think is the effect of – that's the true effect of fake news. Fake news isn't really meant to make you believe that she killed 47 people in Arkansas. I think it's meant to make you disbelieve almost everything else that might be presented.
I want to go back to this idea that you brought up, Alfredo, that we need better media literacy in this country, maybe something that should be added into, you know, formally into school curricula. The way you might teach like a second grade class about journalism, you would say, here's a story, there are two sides to it, and you have to represent both sides. We all know as adults that the world is far more complex than that. But often it seems that people feel like if you report something negative or positive about a person with one political perspective, that you are required to find an equal and opposite set of facts about someone on the other side.
And that is a difficult situation that we face because based on, again, the public reaction and the feedback and the emails and calls that we get, that I get, people demand to be also included on some issues. When we know that their position is not probably a representation of an element of the story, a truth element of the story, I go back to the issue about the tremendous fragmentation that we have in what we call media and everything. I try to go out and listen to people and listen to the public, but also I use, you know, my family and my connections to kind of gauge about what they're interested on. And also because of what I do, and I'm interested on making sure that we report not only the news, but we report truth and facts, that we apply and uphold, you know, good standards on media and journalism. Because of that, I often ask about how people know what they know. And that is very difficult for me. It usually will say, I read that on the internet, or I got a text. And immediately, many will just assume that that's true. I think it has to do with elements of what Mike was talking about, starting with transparency on explaining how we do what we do and how we come to decisions about coverage and including sources and where to go and how do we edit and write those stories. Also explaining about what we do, but also sometimes what we don't do, and saying these are the reasons why we don't do that, we don't cover that, or these are the reasons why we're not going to get into what we may consider fake news or elements that are not principal elements of a potential story that are not worth for us to investigate or spend resources on. I think that we got to start there. One of the things that we've been trying to do a lot in the last few, say, years is trying to team up with universities and schools to try to teach at the very basic level, you know, about media and about news, real news. And I think we need to emphasize those efforts, and we need to do it a lot more often.
How do you each define fake news?
Well, so I want to say what it isn't. Fake news isn't a story, a factual story that you don't like because it doesn't confirm your view of how the world should be. Fake news is a deliberately invented but plausible story meant to make you believe a certain thing politically.
All right. That's Mike Wilson. He is editor of the Dallas Morning News. We'll get a response if the editor of Aldea, Alfredo Carbajal, wants to add to that in just a moment. Actually, we have another minute in this segment. So, Alfredo, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think it's in terms of fake news, there's a motivation behind it. And like all stereotypes, I usually go to that element as a way of contrast. Most stereotypes have some small elements of truth. You know, something happened somewhere. Somebody
just
did
enough
something.
To convince you it's possible.
Something, but you know, we did. Sometimes we apply that and generalize that in a way that that becomes a truth. And I think in the case of fake news, the lack of you know, advanced media literacy, small elements of truth or small facts, you know, may mean like the whole truth for a lot of people. And the complication that we have, though, especially in the last, you know, campaign and in many other elements, it's sometimes groups, special interests groups, individuals, maybe politicians and others will use those small elements to try to spin something.
We're speaking this hour about fake news, real journalism, and the future of reporting with Alfredo Carbajal, who is editor of Aldea, and Mike Wilson, who is editor of the Dallas Morning News. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the future of journalism in a climate of fake news and real news all mixed in together in some people's minds, or at least on their social media feeds. My guests for the hour are Dallas Morning News editor Mike Wilson and Aldea editor Alfredo Carbajal. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Mike Wilson, let's talk a little bit about this idea of what is plausible, because sometimes what's plausible is in fact true, and sometimes what's plausible is still false.
Sure. Well, so my concern is that instead of living in a world of actual information, we are transitioning to a world of merely plausible information.
Could be true.
Could be true. And let me sort of talk about that in a way that takes it out of the national political realm, because when people get excited about fake news, it's usually because it's a partisan political story. But imagine that a fake news story began to circulate that the Dallas Police and Fire Pension Fund is not in fact underfunded by however many billion dollars, but that it's actually perfectly financially solvent and that its insolvency is a ruse that's been peddled to people to excite them, or for whatever reason, that the story begins to circulate and it takes hold deeply among the people of Dallas, and a political movement rises up to make sure nothing is done about that. So that's not a national political story. It's neither Democratic nor Republican in any way that I can fathom. But should that information take hold and gain political traction, then the fact is there's a financial disaster awaiting the city of Dallas that, you know, from which it would be very difficult to recover. So that's what I see as sort of the danger of mere plausibility, that actual news and actual sort of reported information is critical to communities and larger democracies functioning right.
What do we do about stories that don't contain any deliberately false information, but they leave context out that give a false impression? So, for example, somebody might publish a story that says there are no alligators left in the wild in Australia. You hear that and you think that sounds awful, but of course it's crocodiles that are native to Australia. It seems there are lots of sources that want to consider themselves full-fledged news organizations that traffic mostly in political stories and don't want to reveal the whole story.
Well, sure. I mean, you always have to look at the motivation of the news source and the credibility of the history of the news source. You know, that said, I think that what Alfredo has been referring to as responsible news organizations can make that kind of mistake too. I mean, I can go back through our own history and see plenty of times when I felt like, you know, there's an important piece of context there that we should have provided. Now, that said, I do like to say that balance is achieved not a single story at a time or even a single day at a time, but over time, so that I don't feel this compunction to always have three pro this stories with every, you know, with three pro that stories on a given day. You know, let the news do what it's going to do, but make sure that over time you're showing enough viewpoints to give people a broad view of the news.
What's the best way to handle the honest mistakes that get made or the oversights? Some people have complained that, you know, an incorrect story gets everywhere and the correction is often small. And, you know, we're all guilty of wanting to blast our successes and minimize our failures.
So this is a particularly important question in the digital era. We've grown our digital audience enormously in the last few years. And one of the things that we're grappling with as a news organization is how do we let people know when we've messed up online? In print, we've trained readers to expect to see corrections in a certain place every day. And so regular readers can count on finding information about errors in the same place. They may feel that the error should have been as prominent, or the correction should have been as prominent as the error was, and I understand that, but at least there's a consistency to it. Now, digitally, we're instituting standards so that when an error is made, a significant error, that there's an editor's note that indicates here's what the error was, that it repeats, it says this is what the wrong information was, and then says what the right information was. And that goes not just for an error of fact. If I gave your first name as Wendy instead of Chris, we'd correct that. But more also for errors of perception. If a story was simply misguided or based on a wrong premise, we need to own up to that and publish something that says we were wrong about it to keep our credibility.
Alfreda, do you worry in this era when people might share stories that were written by your journalists that people read only the headline and take a conclusion from the headline when the meat of the story may indicate something that's a little bit different?
It happens a lot. And in the many calls that I get or emails that I get of readers and the public complaining or that they want to discuss a story where they feel that we're not accurately representing the essence or what the facts are, often that's what happens, which is people will not read the complete story or will not have a fully account all the sources that we have. But one of the ways in which I answer is now anybody can be an editor. And with all this abundance of sources and channels and platforms, almost you see information left and right of all kinds. What I do is ask people to ask the question, which is ask the question about, you know, how we got the information and how is it that what are the motivations of the sources that we have? And in many cases, it boils down to not being able to read the complete story or not really paying attention to additional sources that we have. That's what we call the context. And I think it's part of that media literacy that I'm talking about, that we're trying to see what we want to see and just confirm the information based on our belief system.
We live in an era where, for the two of you, at least for the online product, you know exactly how far most readers got down. You know the stories that only got a quick scan and the mm-hmm. ones that people stayed with for 10 or 15 minutes. How does that affect the decisions that you make about how much – these days, I guess, online column inches are not a thing, but you do want to think about how much time a reporter should spend writing something that may or may not get fully read.
We have a much better sense now of what the audience really cares about based on those metrics, and we care about what they care about. I will not say, though, that it drives all of our decision-making, because we're here in North Texas to serve, you know, the North Texas community with news and information that matters to them. And sometimes we feel the need to let them know, we think this is very important to you and you should know it. And whether they respond in the same numbers, in the same, you know, with the same enthusiasm that they do to a Dak Prescott, you know, great Cowboys story, it's not so important as long as that information is available to them. But the trying to build an engaged audience is critical to our future in the news business because, as you know, print subscriptions over time have diminished. Print advertising support has diminished, and we're trying to make this transition into a digital world with a digital audience. In order to be able to do journalism at scale, we need to make sure that we have an audience that's very deeply engaged in what we're doing. The good news is that often that means news they haven't heard before. Investigative news is at a premium. And so it's not so much cats on piano keys that's getting people to come back. It's knowing what's really going on that it gets people excited.
And I'll say also in average stories, now with, again, all the digital tools that we have at hand, we can actually do different entry points into the story. That doesn't mean that the facts are going to be different for different kind of audiences. The facts are going to continue to be the facts. But we do a lot of rewriting. We'll have very different headlines from print to digital. We may even have a different way of presenting the news on social media. We may do aggregation, other sources, and additional information. And we'll try to do as much as we can what we call rich media, which is, again, audio, video, or posting the documents that are the source for the story. So it's the traditional news writing for, you know, maybe 20 years ago for newspapers is very different now. And those are different ways in which we're trying to engage, but at the same time, continue to be as responsible as we need to be on front, saying this is the information that we got, and this is how we got it, and you can see it.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Greg calling from Dallas. Hi, Greg.
Hi, guys. Great topic today.
Thanks.
I can kind of trace back people's reliance on, you know, internet media over the big five media news to kind of two contributing factors. I was actually on the Glenn Mitchell Show 10 years ago, and I asked Robert Novak, at what point do you think people will stop relying on the big five media for most of their information and go to the internet exclusively? And he kind of laughed at me, but here we are. You have the Bush administration that wasn't really called out for any of its crimes for the first 10 years of the new millennium. And then also you have the narrowing of the pool of information. There are only five major media resources out there. So if you have people who are thirsty for knowledge, they want accountability in their leaders. And if they're not getting it from the five main sources that they've come to trust over the last 100 years, where are people to go?
Just so we're clear, Greg, what do you mean by the five major news sources?
Well, you've got Fox News Corp, you've got ABC Disney, you've got NBC Sony Universal, you've got Warner, and then I'm not quite sure what the other fifth branch. They own 95% of all the radio stations, TV stations, print media, and now they're starting to creep into the internet.
Well, gentlemen, what about the fact that there's been so much aggregation in the journalism business?
Well, so I think, you know, fewer independent journalistic voices is bad for democracy. And to the extent that they've shrunk, it's problematic. I think that there's obviously a great concentration of audience among some of the groups that he's talked about. But there are a lot of other pretty influential news sources that he hasn't mentioned. Vox Media, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, The Dallas Morning News. There are actually enough sort of, I think, ProPublica is one I should have mentioned, the Marshall Project, 538. So, you know, there are a number of news outlets there that are digging in. I think there's been some interesting commentary made on the dwindling of regional news organizations, that a great deal of the reporting power is concentrated on the coasts at this point and in big cities. And so that's an issue to watch out for.
Well, but I'll say on top of the media that produces journalism, or produces news, it's also the other side, which is, or even part of this, the media that distributes content. And many will argue that probably one of the most powerful media entities is Google, Google News, that they're in the publishing business. And based on your browsing history and based on the sites that you go to and based on many of the algorithms that they take into account, you're going to get a different curation of the kind of news that you have. And Facebook and other social media elements as well. So those are also powerful elements now in media.
Okay, social media is really interesting to me because when you look at, let's be frank and call them fringe sources of information, there are some that if they only existed for their subscribers, their reach would be pretty limited. But when you have an organization like Breitbart, which is a so-called alt-right site, people who might not be inclined to go and seek out that content will see it populating their feeds if only one person out of their hundreds of Facebook friends happens to post it. And that is a different kind of reach than the old days of literally cutting and pasting physical pieces of paper and sending them to a friend you thought might be interested.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think it's a healthy thing that Facebook has started to partner with news organizations to identify stories that don't pass the smell test. That's a very positive thing. But I also think, you know, since the election of President-elect Trump, people in our business have spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, what did we miss? What did we owe to readers and listeners that we didn't give them? And I think those are good conversations to have, and we're having them. I also think that some of the responsibility for having good information rests with the public that consumes that information, that people need to bring a level of skepticism to what we report, but perhaps a higher level of skepticism to the plausible but unlikely stories that they see on the fringes of social media, and really examine those stories for the good of the country and see if they're anything they really want to pass on.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones now in our conversation with Mike Wilson of the Dallas Morning News and Alfredo Carbajal, who is editor of Aldea. Next up, we have Ralph calling from Dallas. Hi, Ralph.
Howdy.
Hi.
My concern is over what I would call fake fact-checking, but I'm really looking for a better name for that. That's one question. The second one is the Texas Standard, for example, uses a group called PolitiFact Texas, and when I track down on their own website how they assessed a particular story that I was concerned about the truth of initially, they admitted that their assessment was based on belief, not facts.
I'm not sure exactly what story that is, but certainly fact-checking sites are something that more people are drawn to these days. And then there are sometimes questions about whether the fact-checking sites can be trusted. How can we know the difference?
Well, so I was at the St. Petersburg Times, now Tampa Bay Times, when PolitiFact was created, and it won a Pulitzer Prize in its first year for the fact-checking work that it did. I think that it has a history of credibly checking stories in a nonpartisan way. That said, while it holds itself out as a fact-checking site, many things that it's checking are very nuanced and can be interpreted in different ways. You know, is a certain thing a fact or a belief? And so there's plenty of room for interpretation in these ratings that they give. And readers should, as this caller has done, readers should bring a skeptical eye to it. And the fact check is not offered as on a stone tablet for readers to simply bow to, but as the interpretation of some journalists who did some work on it, and readers should feel free to say, no, I see it differently.
If a public official says something that is demonstrably untrue, is it editorializing to call it a lie?
It is. It may be editorializing to call it a lie. That's such a broad question, Chris. I think our responsibility is to point out the untruth of the situation and let readers determine for themselves what the motivation of the speaker was. This becomes very difficult because if somebody repeats a falsehood again and again and again, we also have a responsibility to point out that there seems to be some ambition behind that, some point that the person is trying to pursue. You know, it doesn't serve us or readers well to simply say again and again and again that wasn't true. At some point, we have to say this is a pattern for this person to keep saying this. But the word lie is a very, very touchy one.
There are people who worry that if you don't say lie, you normalize the dissemination of falsehoods.
That may be true. I think as we talk about fake news and in terms of being transparent about what we do, just think about the concept of who is a reporter and who is a journalist. It's somebody who's been trained on how to get information, how to write information or disseminate information in different ways. You know, it could be video, TV, radio, print. But also, over time, it's an individual that will develop an expertise on a topic and a theme. We have all kinds of beat reporters at Dallas Morning News, let's say an early writer. You know, obviously, that person is consuming that information about that topic all the time and will offer facts. In terms of what's happening, in terms of, new airlines coming to DFW, new developments, stories that are just regular stories, but also will offer some context and analysis what those elements will mean.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. We are talking about fake news, real journalism, and the future of reporting. We'll come back in a few minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about journalism, fake news, and the future of reporting. If you feel like you kept up with current events in 2016, you might enjoy our Texas News Quiz. You can find the link to test yourself at our website, think.kera.org. If you'd like to join this hour's conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. And Alfredo, before the break, you were talking about the expertise that beat reporters, longtime reporters, bring to the context that they can bring to their reporting.
Yes. What I was alluding to is, what we can offer to the public is, of course, the information in a way that they're going to be able to consume it right away. And that's why we got good writers, we got good anchors, we got good TV reporters, people who knows about how to communicate content. They're just the mechanics of journalism. But also it's about how to get information, the kind of information that we get, how to access information, and the expertise that comes with that. I think I was providing the example of an airline writer, somebody that will not only be reciting press releases out of the airports or, the authorities in charge of aviation, but also in terms of making sense about what that means for consumers, for passengers, for airlines, for the industry, for the economy, for everything. And I think that's part of, what journalism brings. But the other layer that I think that we need to also offer is be as much as transparent as possible about the about transmitting also and making public information that we got, either court documents or audits or reports, everything that we have, we got to just post it. We got to publish that as well. And I think for the most part, we try to do it. So it brings the expertise on journalism and how to communicate, and it's also on top of the added to the expertise of the topic and the theme, but also the information. I go back to the issue that I was discussing earlier, which is I think that we all, journalists and the public in general, we should ask the questions about how do you get that information, where do you get that information, and how do you obtain it, and what is it that information means. I think that brings a lot more transparency.
How do journalists hold one another accountable?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that from organization to organization, there's a great chorus of critics alive on Twitter, so that any journalist who publishes something questionable or poorly sourced will hear about it from outside. Internally, I think that we hold each other accountable through the means of, newsroom hierarchies, so that if our reporters publish something that isn't up to standard, their editors let them know it and work to do it better next time.
It's interesting to me in newsrooms that if a mistake happens, the mistake is the problem, not necessarily the individual. So there's not necessarily, I think, in a really well-functioning newsroom, a need for a reporter who has made a mistake to try and conceal that mistake. Like the climate should be such, right, that you can say, I messed up on this, and we all have to get together to fix it.
Sure. In our newsroom, we're working on on an honor system, on an assumption, especially in a digital publishing age, that if something was published that's incorrect, that the person who published it, whether he or she realized it herself or was told by somebody else, is going to step forward and say, yikes, this is wrong, we need to fix it. I mean, I got to fall on my sword here. My experience in 33 years in newsrooms is that there's a very high standard for professionalism, that what journalists want is to be really good at what they do. They want to be good journalists. And so, so many times I see journalists coming forward and saying, I'm horrified. This is an error. You almost have to sort of talk them through it and say, look, stuff happens. It's going to be okay. We'll correct it and we'll get it right.
We are certainly grown-ups, and most journalists that I know have very thick skins. But why do you think, Alfredo, that so many people outside of the profession kind of despise members of the media as a general rule?
Boy, I struggle with that because, again, I see myself as a journalist who's trying to do the right thing. I think it's our main asset in journalism is credibility. Whether we have it or not, and that concept is an absolute. It's nothing's perfect, but nothing's horrible all the time. And I think sometimes outside of the public, it's probably the lack of understanding on how we do news, and that has to do also, again, sometimes because we are not as transparent as possible or as we need to, but also because our mistakes. And I think the role of media and journalism is we hold people accountable, and especially authorities and people in positions of power. We also need to be accountable to the public and have systems. Mike was talking about a system in which we have a corrections policy and a consistent corrections policy. There have been many studies. I remember one study from, maybe some 10 years ago from ASNE, the American Society of News Editors, about credibility. And the number one, the main takeaway of that is it says that when you commit a mistake and you acknowledge that and you own it, the public will actually forgive you for that. They will see that you are trying to do honest work. Now, you can make mistakes every day, then that's a different story. You're not good enough in terms of the standards. But, assuming that you have good standards and you explain how you know what you know, how you got information and what that information needs, and you make an honest effort and you are transparent, I think people will understand that it's just a mistake, and then you move on and you correct it and you try to do better.
Can I add a perspective to this too?
Yeah.
I think that's right. I think there are a couple of other things. Journalism is a difficult business. We go into places and ask people really impertinent, difficult questions at the worst possible time for them and demand answers right then. We may not always be polite about it, and because politeness is not necessarily you know, what's required for the job. Secondly, I don't think you can discount the very long campaign that's been waged in this country to discredit real good journalism and good journalists. There is a national cable news channel very dedicated to the idea that you cannot trust what the mainstream media tells you. And so that kind of public relations muscle waged against quality journalism is very hard to combat.
You mentioned earlier, Mike, that it might be helpful to label particular stories. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think that in the age of the internet, it may not be clear to readers sometimes what is opinion. What is news? Maybe we need to be clearer about saying this is a news story, or if this is an opinion story, here's the writer and here's where the writer gets the credentials to say what, you know, what he or she is saying. Some of the conventions of newspapers have not translated well to the digital world, and maybe we haven't done a good enough job of simply explaining what we're doing.
We have an email here from Brandon who says, news media have always depended on advertising for survival. With the addition of online to the business model, are there other options for funding news?
Well, you know, I think the industry is legacy newspaper industry is excited to see what the Washington Post and New York Times have done in building subscription audiences. The New York Times now explicitly says it is a subscription-based company. It continues to sell advertising and will still do that because there's money in it and it's profitable revenue. But it's it sees its future as serving audiences who subscribe. And, you know, frankly, in Dallas, we think that's a big part of our future as well. You know, a big part of our effort now will be to get to serve readers in a way that they'll be willing to pay for the unique, differentiated content that we give. So, you know, we're very hopeful that there's a good model there.
1-800-933-5372 if you'd like to join our conversation is the telephone number. Let's go now to Holly in Dallas. Hi, Holly.
Hi. I have a question for either guest, if you're familiar with the Fairness Doctrine and how it was repealed by the Reagan administration in 1987 that some arguably say led to conservative radio and more partisan news. It was the doctrine that required broadcast media to report contrasting views on all the major issues. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Thanks for your call.
I don't think there's any question that the Fairness Doctrine had a major impact on broadcast media or the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine. There's a reasonable argument to be made that, you know, the government shouldn't be in the business of ensuring fairness in media, that we're supposed to have a free and unfettered press. I'll leave that argument to others, but I agree with the caller that there's been a distinct change in the way media works since that time.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with two journalists about fake news, real journalism, and the future of reporting. My guests are Mike Wilson, who's editor of the Dallas Morning News, and Alfredo Carbajal, who is editor of Aldea. What should newsrooms do to eliminate the possibility of implicit bias in reporting?
I think you got to start with the basics of journalism, which is, you know, stick to the facts. But even before that, I think you got to hire the right people, and journalists who are trained with making those calls about, you know, what's opinion, what's fake news, what's not, what are not, you know, real facts, and have the systematic approach to go out and find the right information and through the legal channels, and if you have, you know, people who are trained on how to do that, and then you have systems in place. You got them. One of the things that I like about what I do and what we do is we edit. And I always tell my staff to say, you know, we sometimes reporters, you start with something and then others participate and then the editor gets involved. And at the end of the process, we have a better story with as many elements that we need to have, the important elements of the story, but also safeguards and making sure that we're not, overlooking elements that may be important to the story or we're not taking a direction that where the story shouldn't be. I always say, you know, the editing process works. That's quality control. And I think you have the right people in place, you got the systems in place, and you have the values that everybody understood those values, then the chances are you're going to have much better journalism.
I think another hedge against implicit bias is diversity in a newsroom. And I don't just mean racial and ethnic diversity, though those are very important, and we haven't done as well as we need to on those points. But I also think diversity of experience, diversity of backgrounds, having different kinds of people in the newsroom who take a different point of view on things is going to be important.
Have you both had shining results in encouraging your staffs to be on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and other social media to communicate about their stories?
I think so. I'm really excited about what the Dallas News and Aldea staffs have done in terms of building social media presence. It's been a big push in the last couple of years since I've been editor to get our journalists to build a relationship with readers so that they can find an audience for their work, know the audience for your work, and direct that work towards those people. That's kind of the strategy for us serving the audience.
It's hard to get nuance into 140 characters sometimes, though.
Absolutely. And so, you know, and of course, tweets, you know, a lot of times is where nuance and balance can go to die if you're not careful, right? I think overall our journalists have been very, very careful and responsible in their tweeting.
And I'll say on that is, it's not just about the dissemination of news or promoting the journalism that we do. And of course, that helps us with connecting with different communities, but also helps us with a more horizontal connection with the larger public. And in many cases, those communications and those tweets or posts on Facebook, Instagram, and many other channels, they do result on us learning about things, on stories getting richer, and I think that's a really good dynamic that we're barely starting to see the impact of that relationship it's going to continue to change and evolve.
When either one of you hires somebody who's just been out of school for maybe a couple of years, how do their career expectations differ from what we all expected when we got into the business years ago?
It's interesting. I'm very fascinated with that element because I had to manage a staff that probably the majority will, you know, has a lot of experience and they come from different generations and different expectations and different ways of approaching, you know, their careers and the job that they do. But also we hire people right out of college or interns, and it's different. The dynamic is very different. I like the fact that we can incorporate that element as part of what Mike was saying in terms of the diversity, because I think that we can learn a lot from there. The days when people say, well, you got to pay your dues, that doesn't mean a lot to, or doesn't mean almost nothing to somebody who just graduated and may have a different expectation, saying, you know, I'm not here for life. You know, I'm here to learn. Mm-hmm. This is an experience for me. It's a job, of course, but I want to learn and I want to contribute. And I wanted to make it relevant to my belief system. It's a different expectation, and it's difficult to manage in some cases. But I think if we do the right thing, it will enrich our newsrooms and also our journalism.
Alfredo Carbajal is editor of Aldea. Mike Wilson is editor of the Dallas Morning News. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.